Happy Easter weekend. It's Jaded Gamercast, and I'm happy to announce that on this happy Easter weekend, I am already drunk.
I would say that's new for Jaded Gamercast, but we both know that it's absolutely par for the course by this time.
I wasn't going to drink any more for the rest of the night because I was done at around 8. Finished watching the new Doctor Who at around 9, and I was just like, I'm ready for bed. I am so drunk. And then I remembered that it was time to podcast. And hey, guess what? I've got another glass of scotch in my hand. Nathan, what are you drinking?
Guinness.
Of course.
Well,
good
hey, look.
Times.
We settle into these familiar ruts. Yeah. Hey, look, it's not my fault that when the podcast started, I was on a diet and couldn't drink. So I kept trying to like skirt around the drinking issue. And then because I was on a diet, I had shit for liquor when I was off of it. So I was always just like, what can I scrounge in the house? But now that I'm prepared and it's a Saturday night routine, shit, son, there is Guinness in the house.
There it is. Oh my God. Okay, so we've got a topic that I think is going to generate some pretty good conversation today. But before we get into that, let's talk about higher learning for this week, which is Ogre Kingdoms for Warhammer Fantasy.
The now, second most deserving army of a new book.
Oh, go fuck yourself. No. It is the most deserving of a new army. See, I was going to wait till we got into this. You and I had this drawn out conversation about which army is more pathetic, wood elves or ogres, and we both have a very differing viewpoint about whether which army needs and or deserves a new army book next.
Oddly now, enough, it's always the army that neither of us plays. I'm just like, no, my army needs it more. Your army is better. No.
No, sir. My army needs it more. Your army is better. Yes. But Ogre Kingdoms, I played them from the moment they came out. I was painting up the pre-releases, and I had a full army done before most people had an army to begin with. It was always a mix of different things because when you work for Games Workshop and you get pre-release models when they come out and you're excited for that army, you have to paint it in a short period of time, and B, you have to paint pretty much whatever is released, which is pretty much one box of everything. So this was definitely an army that I had a very, very wide mix of things that I started with. But I'm not going to go too far into kind of what I have with my army. I want to get into the book itself. Like, let's talk a little bit about the tactics. I think that this is a great starter army for somebody who's eager to get into Warhammer because it's an army where you really don't have to paint that many models. And I mean, like, we laugh and we joke about, like, oh, if you play Grey Knights, you only have to paint, like, half as many models. Like, no. Ogre Kingdoms? My 2,500-point Ogre Kingdom army is literally, like, 35 models, if even that. Mm-hmm. Right?
Like, oh, yeah. Like, I was going balls to the wall when I was trying to do one. And unless you take Noblars, 2,500 points, I'm just like, 40 guys. Man, that's a big army.
But why would you take Noblars? And I think that that's a good point as well. I mean,
why? Because Noblars are fantastic for blocking and grinding and steadfast because they're fucking 2 points a model.
Listen, I understand that they're cheap, and I understand that for the points, they make up their points. I'm not saying that they're good for the points or they're bad for the points, but we can all agree they do make up their points in some way, shape, or form. And when you're talking about a 2-point model, it's almost always going to make up its points. It's like slaves for Skaven, right?
Well, yeah, absolutely.
But slaves for Skaven are still better than Noblars, right? I just think that, you know, in an army like that, trying to shoot for steadfast or trying to, you know, play the horde or all these different strategies with that big unit, it always feels very out of place. And I kind of talked about this a little bit when we talked about the Orc and Goblins as well. I feel like with everything else on the table, I don't feel like Noblars supplement that army well. I feel like they're just out of place. And so I've never used them. The only reason why I use a 10-man unit of trackers is so that I can get a scrap launcher. But all it really does is make a scrap launcher 70 points more expensive than it should be, which is kind of a pain in the ass.
Then take the minimum size unit instead of buffing it up some. No, I mean, I think with Noblars, Noblars are fantastic if you are going to run the Death Star Horde. And that's really what it comes down to. Because if you want to run like 21 or 22 ogres and get a +3 rank bonus and horde formation and tossing characters and just really just sink your points into that, you really, really, really need to invest a couple hundred points in Knoblars just to guard your flanks, because you are giving up a lot of mobility by choosing to bunker and go the Death Star route instead of the MSU route. So I mean, you know, they're obviously gonna, if they're on either flank of a Death Star, they're within range of Inspiring Presence and the BSB, which means that if you just invest 100 points per unit, you can have a unit that's 5x10 and is basically going to intercept a charge, hold, so you're not going to get flanked, and allows you to maneuver your Death Star out of the way or go charge something and just get the fuck out of there. And that's where I really see Knoblars, you know, kind of excelling, is just, like I said, being flank protectors of a gigantic unit that you don't want bad shit to happen to. If you're not going to do that, though, I'm with you. You know, Knoblars are, you know, sure, you could take a unit and just try to throw them in there and hope you're within range of Inspiring Presence in the BSB to make sure that they're going to tie up that unit of Chosen for 3 or 4 rounds of combat, but eh?
Right. But, you know, like, I think what really kind of becomes a problem here is, you know, and I don't want to get into this too quickly, but when you're playing a Death Star, your deployment is very strange, right? Like, and this is any army in general, but it's particularly tricky when you're playing with Ogre Kingdoms, because you have so few models that if you're going to play a Death Star, it's very, very hard to supplement it. Now, yes, if you're going to use Knoblars in that respect, I do agree that they will perform their function just fine, right? Mm-hmm. The problem is, if there's another unit in there that's going to get on the flank of those Knoblars, they crumble very, very quickly. And if you're going to put a character in against that flank, or if there's any sort of magic in against that flank, you know, 5x10, great, good for you. I mean, 50 Knoblars, 50 wounds, why the hell not? I mean, 2 points a wound is worth it, at least at that point. But they get chewed through very, very quickly. And this is kind of always what I keep saying to you, Nathan, when you and I have these conversations. I'm like, yeah, Nathan, but you don't play a Horde. Like, you don't play Undead. You don't play that Horde style. Like, you have no idea how quickly that shit can turn south. Like, oh, you know, hey, 50 is great. 20 is not enough. And you get from 50 to 20 very, very quickly if you're in a bad situation.
No, you know? It's true. But, I mean, even if that Knoblar unit gets flanked, unless they get flanked by something with more than 10 ranks, they keep their steadfast. And the whole point of that is to be the roadblock to make sure that your Death Star doesn't get munched.
But you're always assuming that they're having more ranks than their opponent. I mean, yes. Okay, 5x10, sure. Right? Like, you're almost always going to have that, right? But when you start pulling them off that quickly, those ranks start to fall apart really, really quick. And after two turns, and I'm talking two full turns, which is 4 rounds of combat, you're not going to have the ranks that you need to stay steadfast, especially if somebody has you in the flank.
You're absolutely right, but all you're looking for is something that's going to hold your opponent up for a turn that allows you to maneuver.
Two turns
out.
Of holding them up is good. I said before they will perform the job, right? But when I look at this army and I look at kind of the way that it's built, there are other units that are either going to hit back harder on the flank, or they're going to hold the flank with, you know, it's going to make your opponent stop and, you know, take his time a little bit more. Lead Belchers are a great example of that, because they're totally random. But if somebody comes and they charge in against the Lead Belchers, there's a good chance that they're going to lose a lot of guys. Like, they're going to get shot to pieces. And we're talking about flank units here, right? And again, we'll kind of get into this a little bit more later when we start talking about deployment, which is the subject of this podcast today. But I think, like, when you're talking about flank units, you're not talking about, you know, 6 ranked big units that are going to try to push through a flank. We're talking about small units, 1 to 2 ranks at most, typically monsters. And in situations like that, again, are the Knoblars maybe the best way to go? Okay, yeah, possibly. But you can also push that flank with Lead Belchers, Iron Guts, Rhinox Riders, a Giant, Gorgers. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not great units. They they're all overpriced, but they will push through those flank style units. But
you know, like I said, it's true. But that's why, like I said, you know, my whole thing on Noblars is cost efficiency. If you know, and as I said,
I don't want to paint them
specifically. Oh God, I hear you. 200 here, it's 100 Noblars.
But I painted 10. I wanted to slip my own wrists.
Point for point, if you are looking for something that is literally just going to stall a flanking unit from getting from getting into your Death Star, nothing will beat the Noblars, because two lead belchers will cost more points and do way less, you know, be far less successful in, like I said, just blocking a unit and keeping them in place for a turn or two.
Right.
You know, so I mean, that's the thing. I mean, we had that long argument, and let's kind of get off Noblars and kind of look at the rest of
Magic.
Of the list. I don't magic.
See, you always shrugged it off, but I'm just like, no, their magic is so gimped. Like, it's okay. In 8th edition.
No, I'm sorry, but when every wizard can one die cast and has lore master, you can't talk to me about fucking gimped when wood elves have the lore of Athaloran.
I'm not
Athaloran.
I'm going to cut you off right here, because we're not talking about your goddamn wood elves, just like we're not talking about your goddamn Tyranids, okay? We're talking about ogres right now. We all know Athaloran sucks, okay? We all right. know it sucks. But listen, when you look at the Ogre Kingdom's magic, yes, everybody has lore master. Yes, everything casts on a 3. But what you have to understand is that when you're talking about supplementing your army and or doing damage, there's only 3 spells in that lore that do anything, right? One is dependent on your opponent not having flaming attacks, and the other 2 give you +1 strength and +1 toughness, which can be given to you in one spell via wild form, right? In the lore of beasts, right? Now, the kind of cool thing about what they did in 8th edition with the errata to the ogres list is that they removed the section that said that any one ogre unit can only have one ogre spell cast on, like one of the quote-unquote remain-in-play ogre spells cast on it at any given time, meaning that you can stack abilities, right? So you can, if you've got 2 wizards, you can cast Toothcracker twice on the same unit, and they have +2 toughness instead of +1. Now, again, I look at this and I'm just like, but you can do that with lore of life now as well. The problem is not that it's easy to cast, because okay, we all get it. It's easy to cast. If you've got a level 2 wizard and you roll 2 dice, 99% of the time you're going to be casting that spell. Hooray, yay, super awesome, right? The problem is that a level 4 with 2 dice is guaranteed to always be dispelling your stuff. And when you've only got 3 spells worth of stuff that you can use, your opponent always knows which one is the most important to discast, to dispel. On an average dice roll for gut magic, you're probably going to get 3 to 4 spells off. I mean, if they're your 3 good spells, awesome. But your opponent knows, I'm going to dispel Troll Guts, I'm going to dispel Toothcracker. You know, oh, hey, he's got +1 strength, but because I'm steadfast, who cares? They dispel it in the following turn, almost guaranteed. And then the resulting turn of combat, because they were steadfast last turn against you, it's just your ogres being ripped to shreds, right? Right now, kind of the strategy that goes around with a lot of ogre players is to have a level 4 slaughter master and a butcher, so that you can be casting 2 at a time. Because, yeah, you also got to remember that every single piece of gut magic, when you get a successful cast, it does damage to your wizard. You know, like, yeah, they've got a bunch of extra wounds, but you'd be surprised how quickly that adds up. So in, you know, turn 3 after casting for 2 consecutive turns, you're usually casting Blood Gruul just to get those wounds back. So you're wasting spells just to get those wounds back. You know, so I mean, I just think that it's a problematic lore that's easily gimped. Can it be great? Oh God, yes, it can totally be great. Like any magic lore, it can be phenomenal, right? In the right situation. But if you're playing against an experienced general, it doesn't cut the mustard.
That's yeah, right. But I mean, basically, you have just argued for and against using magic in Warhammer, because no, that's true of any that. Lore. No, fuck you.
No, it's not. You're not talking lore. About no, something that listen, you can listen, automatically shut, dispel shut the next fuck turn. Up.
Uh-huh. Yeah, but okay, so you're saying that you are displeased at the fact that your opponent, who's using a quote-unquote better lore, is not casting spells at you because he's taking power dice to dispel. So that means you get more dispel dice to actually dispel his stuff, and he gimps himself saying, "I won't cast any spells this turn." And that's a bad thing.
Right,
So, I
but you
mean,
don't
first of
understand
all,
how
you're
important
fucked in
their
the
magic
head.
is to the ogres. You don't understand how important those three spells are to making an ogre army good.
And second of all, you're saying that gut magic is crap because good generals know what spells to dispel, but that's true of every single lore of magic in the game. Lore of life is crap because if you dispel Throne of Vines, well, then what can they do? You
No.
know, like I said, every
No.
single lore has these spells that hinge on it. So, I mean, it really,
Okay,
like you said, you're just
that is
blowing
true,
smoke
but
out
you're
of your
wrong.
ass by
No,
saying
you're
that.
so fucking out of the off the wall here, because listen to me. Okay, you're gonna cast Wissen's Wild Form. Or let's talk about Lore of Light, since you brought up Lore of Light, okay?
I
You've
said
got
life,
four. Oh, okay, well, I'm gonna say light because it's better. You've got four good spells that come out of this, right? You've got Fog's Protection, you've got Speed of Light, you've got Barona's Time Warp, and you've got, any of the other
And
extra
odds
good
are you
spells.
are not lore master, so do you have all
Odds
of
are.
those
Odds
spells?
are.
No.
No, but odds are on a level four, you could get those. We're talking about if you've got three good spells, right? You roll decent enough without Lore Master and you've got your three good spells, right? Your opponent knows that if you get Fog's Protection off, he can't dispel it. It's done. He has to deal with that through his next turn, right? That is not the case with Gut Magic. With Gut Magic, you can let shit go for a turn, knowing that in your power phase, you can just dispel it. And knowing that the following combat, when you're the one who's getting flank charges, you can just dispel the spell that's literally keeping him alive, so that now he's got no buffs whatsoever. One of the good things about Magic in 8th edition is that you can preemptively cast stuff knowing that he's going to charge you in his turn, right? You can prepare for that kind of stuff. There's none of that happening in the Ogre Kingdom's army, right? And again, the casting values go up for every time you want to cast a spell twice. It doubles the casting value, or
Oh
even.
my God, to a
I
six.
know, to
Oh,
a six.
Jesus Christ.
Oh my God, like a
So what
lot
you're
of
saying is
spells
to
in the
start.
regular 8th edition, but
Yeah.
that's what
So
I'm saying.
start with your
That's why
butcher
it's
that
on
casts
the
on
turn.
a three with a plus two, and then end with your slaughter master who
See, but you
casts on a
think that
six
just
with a
because he
plus.
can cast it on a three that, oh my God, it's so crazy good. Hey,
No,
good for me.
my point
I get one good round
is
of
when you
combat where
look
I'm
at
not
it.
getting rid of your steadfast.
No, but seriously, when you look at it, your wizards are still have a great combat stat line because they're ogres.
I'll
They're
still
all
take it
lore
over
masters.
Athelorn. We all
You
know
have
that's the case.
You're all lore master. You all have very low to cast shit. And so who fucking cares that you have remain in play spells? Like it's just like your whole argument is they're all remain in plays instead of lore of lights, which are just, oh, until the beginning of my next turn. Therefore, the lore is fucking
It's
stupid.
not that they're
Because
just remain in plays, okay?
So I mean that's why, like I said, it's just like your whole points on why gut magic is stupid is a reason why taking magic is stupid in 8th
No.
edition because a smart general will know what to do.
Oh, you're absolutely
Congrats, well,
wrong.
shit. But
Listen, in
what
7th edition, you could dispel it on a 7, which was actually dispelling it on a 7. In 8th edition, you dispel it on a 3. A level 4, if he rolls anything on 2 dice other than double ones, it's gone. Whereas before, he actually had to throw 3 dice in there and hope for a decent roll to actually get rid of these spells. Now it's just like, ah, spell's gone, fuck it.
But he's taking two power dice out of his casting, which is
Yes,
two
but on the
power
big
dice
turns of
you do
magic roll,
not
who
have
gives a
to.
shit? Because he dispelled 2 of the 3 good spells in the last power. Anyways, you're so full of it. You don't even know what you're talking about.
I don't
Anyway,
drunk.
you don't. Hey,
Nice.
I'm still drunk and I know what I'm talking about. But no. But anyways,
I'm
magic.
still
I personally feel like
unconscious.
gut magic needs to be fixed. It's broken. The errata broke it even further.
Gut magic is going to get brought into line the same way the
Yes,
incantations on
of
Two
course.
Kings did.
I think that
But
that's what
I
we
mean,
need.
for now, the point the fact remains that is gut magic the best lore in the game? Absolutely not. Is
No.
gut magic stupid? Absolutely not. Does taking it and relying on it screw your ogre army? Absolutely not. And that's the point. Is gut magic right now is this happily mediocre thing where it's just like everything that you say is a negative against it also has pluses. And that's why I'm
Yes.
just like, I just think you're way too doom and gloom about it. And
I've been in too many situations where it's all great and well and good until one turn your opponent just knows what to do. I mean, a veteran general knows which spells to just turn off
But
to just make
again,
your army fall apart.
as we talked in our last episode about fucking lores of magic, we literally went through and did all that where it's just like, no, kill this spell. Yeah, you can let everything else go through. That's okay, but just kill this spell and you're gravy.
All I'm saying is it's not as detrimental. It's not as detrimental on the other lores. In this one, it's a lot easier to pick.
The other lores are fantastic. Yeah. Again, I think we can all agree it's happily mediocre.
Okay, so let's talk about core. I mean, ogres have really one of the best cores in the game. I mean, it's what makes them ogres, right? I mean, this is what sets this army apart from every other army in the game is the fact that every single piece of core other than Noblars is monstrous infantry. So you're talking about stomp attacks. And I mean, like, they were such a weird army book in 7th edition because they were just so random. And, like, I was almost ready to sell my ogres at one point in 7th edition because they were just, oh, my God. Like, you couldn't win games against a good general. And if you did win games, it was like you were lucky. Like, you were just running on the dice. Please give me the dice. Please give me the dice. Because you just couldn't do it. You know, everybody knew it was just like, oh, you want to gimp an ogre army? Just walk within 6. They don't get a bullet charge. It's terrible. And then that would gimp the army because you couldn't get enough attacks, especially since they were striking first. And a lot of times they would kill an ogre out of the front rank. And it was just like, okay, 6 attacks with my big unit of ogres. Ah, 4s.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Because, you know, back in 7th edition, there was really no identifying monstrous infantry as being different or better. There's no supporting attacks. Getting a rank did require you to have 10 bloody ogres, which is at minimum, what, 350 points on bulls?
Yeah.
Something stupid like that to get a +1 to your combat res.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, you're absolutely right. In 7th edition, you know, when I was at a tournament, if I drew an ogre army, it was, you know, I wouldn't say I was just like free win, but it was one of those autopilot games where it's just like, nope, I'm just going to find the unit with his general in it. I'm going to pepper it with so many arrows that he's going to be down to absolutely nothing.
Which you've done against me back in 7th edition.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
On a regular basis.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, or actually my favorite one was find the unit, you know, find a small unit. And then wipe it to a man, which would cause panic checks, and ogres are notoriously low leadership. So they then, oh, look, the army ran away. Hey, I don't have to deal with that half the board. Yes. You know, so I mean, like, it was just random, dumb stuff like that. But now with the changes to monstrous infantry giving them stomp, that's a little more predictable.
Yeah.
You know, you can always rely on 3 hits. And when you're a low weapon skill army like ogres, getting automatic hits is fantastic. You know, you've got ranks at 3, you've got supporting attacks. Like, it's just, you look at all of the benefits to ogres right now, which are all core rulebook changes to monstrous infantry.
Yes.
And that is why their core is just fantastic. Because whether it's a bull or whether it's an iron gut, although I personally prefer bulls, but, you know, iron guts are still fantastic. They're just great with the changes. You're doubling your number of attacks. You're getting bull charges now are easier because with longer charges, it's harder to just sort of march into 6 before the ogre player gets a chance to initiate a charge. you know, plus your stomp, plus your supporting. And it's just, you know, ogres now, as long as you can make them hold the ground with, you know, BSBs and even the crown of command is a beautiful thing on a tyrant.
Yeah.
You know, it's just they become a little more reliable in places where they were very unreliable in the past. So, I mean, that's why for me, even to this day, I still kind of toy with doing an ogre army because I'm just like, dude, it's like 30 guys.
Yes, exactly. It's all skin tones, right? Like, I mean, I painted this army in 3 weeks for the most part. So, I mean, like, it paints up very, very quickly. One of the things that I would really like to see come out of 8th edition ogres when the book gets redone is the book has some very strange imbalances. And what I mean by this is that, you know, with the changes in 8th edition stomp and the random charge ranges and kind of the additional distances that guys can charge, you almost know for sure now that you're typically always getting your bull charge and you are typically always getting your stomps. So what you're seeing a lot of is naked bulls, referred to as naked bulls. Just an ogre club, no light armor, no additional hand weapon, no iron fist, no nothing. Because there's no point. Like, it's too expensive to try to put all that extra garbage in when you're not getting it from your supporting attacks. So people have been running just naked bulls, just bulls with a ogre club, no armor, They run in, they get their impact hits, they get their stomp hits, and they get three attacks apiece at minus one armor. Bing, bang, boom, happy day. I would like to see in the new book either two hand weapons or the Iron Fist coming as a standard, right? Mm-hmm. Because I don't like the idea of these armies coming out where it's just naked bulls, because it just doesn't work with the army. They should have some armor. They should have as many hand weapons as possible. It shouldn't be this kind of min-maxing style of you just running naked bulls for points economy. Mm-hmm. The other weird thing about the book is that it was very clear soon after the book came out that there was a unit that wasn't there. They wanted it to be there. Somebody came up with the idea after the fact and was just like, it's brilliant. What the fuck were we thinking? And since then, it's been a staple for most ogre armies is the Rhinox Riders.
Mm-hmm.
It's a cavalry model in a unit that doesn't necessarily require cavalry, but, you know, big, heavy hitting, you know, like super tough, hard to kill type unit. And I mean, I converted up three Rhinox Riders for my army from scratch. And it's like, you know, this is something that's been missing from the book. And even though it was just a White Dwarf article, you know, like it's in Army Builder, it's, you know, allowed in tournaments. Yeah. It's like everybody has accepted is part of the army.
I don't know, though. I mean, I think that's the biggest problem is if it was universally accepted, that'd be great. But when it comes to tournaments, taking Rhinox Cav is such a crapshoot. Like, it's always a contact the TO because half the tournaments you go to will say, yeah, it's fine. Fuck, ogres are gimped as it stands. And then the other half are just like, is it in the codex? No. Go fuck yourself. Like, you know, yeah. So it's just...
I've honestly never had a tournament turn them down.
Yeah, you know, some of the bigger ones down in Neighborstan will turn them down.
I could imagine the douchier ones would, yes.
Yes, absolutely. You know, but you're absolutely right, because in an army of, you know, light armor wearing, you know, which is basically no save, let's be honest.
Right.
No save and everything sort of three attacks. This unit that was super tough, had lots of wounds, good armor, and lots of higher strength attacks was missing. And yeah, you're right. You know, it's one of those things that everyone knows it'll be in the next army book, because you're absolutely right. It is one of those staple units that everyone's just like, what were we thinking? How did this not get in? Like, right. How did our proofreaders miss it?
How did the designers miss it?
Yeah.
But okay, not to spend too much time on ogres here. But I will say this kind of as a last thing for ogres. Right now, the primary tactic seems to be the Ogre Death Star, which, as you had said before, is pretty much putting all your eggs into one basket and running an ogre unit of 15 to 20 naked bulls with, you know, 3 to 4 characters in that one unit, where the butchers are in the second rank and essentially out of harm's way. And all of your magic is being cast onto one unit to essentially make that unit as invincible as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is kind of an interesting situation, as I said before, because you're playing an army with so few models and so few units that you have to deploy in a very, very strange way. And I built a list like this recently with my ogres, and I put them on the table and kind of tried to come up with, like, okay, how's my deployment going to look for this army? And I got to tell you, I mean, I barely used 2 to 3 feet worth of the table space, probably 2.5 feet worth of like a 6-foot table space, because you just don't have that much room to maneuver, and you have to stay within the banner, and you have to stay within the general's leadership, and you have to try to protect those flanks as much as possible and really kind of fight off any sort of, you know, flanking attack that would come after this unit. And when I tried to look at this against other armies that I would be playing against, I mean, it was fairly clear that even units that weren't supposed to be flanking would be on my flank, because my whole army is like one fucking unit.
Yeah.
Which brings us to the topic of today's show, which is deployment. I mean, I think you can agree with me here. 40K's deployment is a lot more forgiving than fantasy deployment.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, 40K deployment is based a little bit more about terrain, mm-hmm. a little bit more about line of sight, and armies are so, I mean, as we've said before, it's rock, paper, scissors. I mean, if you're playing against a Tau army, you're deploying to hug the cover as you charge forward. If you're playing a Tau army, you're deploying literally just in cover. Like, it's almost as simple as that. Like, there's very, very little strategy that goes into 40K deployment outside of kind of those middle of the road, I do a little bit of both armies, like Space Marines, where deployment is, again, very, very forgiving no matter how you deploy. And you can deploy one way as much as the other.
I think that's oversimplifying it quite a bit, and we'll talk about it. I think the biggest reason fantasy deployment is harder and requires a little more tact and a little more planning is simply because in 40K, if I goof because I wanted to charge with Unit A, but Unit B is blocking, I can move Unit B out of the way in the movement phase and then charge later in the turn.
Yes.
If I do that exact same goof in fantasy, Unit A doesn't charge. They've lost the chance. Unless I can execute a successful charge on a different target with the unit in front to basically open the way.
Which could be just as problematic.
Yes, absolutely. But even then, I did need to have line of sight to declare before I move anything. Right. So, I mean, it is one of those things where in fantasy, you just because of the turn sequence, I find you really have to be more mindful of where things are going down. Plus, in 40K, I mean, I don't even think 5th edition mentions the general anymore because it's a meaningless term, you know. In fantasy, your general boosts your army, and so you always want to make sure, are my important units within range of the general and within range of the battle standard bearer? And so there's just a lot more elements that affect your army as a whole, whereas in 40K, every unit is an island unto themselves. Right. I mean, I think the only exception to this is Tyranids because the synapse rule means that at least I have to have the buddy system. Mm-hmm. Does everyone have their synapse buddy? Fantastic. We're good to go.
Yes, sir, Mr. Nathan.
Yes.
No, and I agree with you there. I mean, it's a very strange situation when you look at 40K because for a while, 40K was a big deployment game. And, it was based as much around the terrain as anything else. When you played 6th and 7th edition fantasy, deployment won and lost games. I mean, you could look at two different opponents and how they deployed, and you could say with, 80% certainty who was going to win just off of deployment. Mm-hmm. Now, that's changed a little bit in 8th edition. It's not quite as heavy on, this hardcore deployment, but the same rules apply. Now, I'm going to talk about me personally here a little bit. I always deploy with a 3-4 turn plan. It's almost always the same, and it almost always is the same regardless of my opponent or terrain or anything like that. And that's kind of the way that I deploy. I always know that this is the center of my army. I know that these are going to be my flanking units. I know that these are going to be my supporting units. I know that these are my bunker units. My vampire counts, my lizard men, in almost all the games I've played, I've deployed the exact same way. And I've been successful with it, right? Because, again, I've got that 3-4 turn plan. By turn 4, I'm usually kind of running around a little bit more randomly. The plan's not really, sticking together anymore as units start to crumble.
I'm winging it.
Right. You have to start playing the reaction game. I mean, this is a dice game. We've talked about it before. In 40K, it's not really the case. Like, I do deploy with a plan, but it, like you say, everything is an island unto itself. So it's how am I deploying my islands, right? Like, I know mm-hmm. that these two units are going to be together because that's what they do and they complement each other. But this unit could be on the flank. It could be in the middle. It could be all over. It's more of a reactionary thing, kind of looking at how my opponent is deploying as opposed to anything else. But still, it's kind of like 2-3 units will be always deployed together for that good synergy on the table and for that hitting power that I'm looking for, the defensive power, like my orcs. I'm always going to deploy my mech boy, my big mech with, the big hordes of guys in the middle of the table. That's never going to change, right? But the trucks, the tanks, the bikes, the knobs, the death copters, the killicans, I mean, whatever. They're always going to be in some random position wherever the hell I feel like putting them, But the size of the army has a huge, huge impact on how you deploy.
Yes. I don't know. I was waiting for you to keep talking. Because You basically just kind of hung off mid sentence, so I'm just like, oh shit, he's done. Yes.
I was
No,
trying to
I
like
mean,
transition to you in non-obvious ways, and Roy's just sitting there
huzzah.
like, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. No, but I mean, you are right though, because I mean, if you're deploying, if you're playing with a Death Star, basically what you're going to do is you're going to deploy your Death Star in the position that's going to give it its best chance. And that's typically the middle of the board, sometimes off center if there's terrain in the middle or whatever, because you really want to give them a clear line of sight. And then absolutely everything else is defending your Death Star, blocking flanks, doing this, doing that, but basically everything supports that one unit. And that's when you run into issues where you're not using a whole lot of the table, as you said. On the other hand, if I'm running a sort of MSU style army where I got tons and tons of units, at that point, you really do need to have a plan because you start creating traffic jams for yourself. And I've won games off of this. I've won games
Yes.
versus, because
Well, that was how you
I've
beat orcs in fantasy
oh,
in
absolutely,
the
because
last
if
two
you.
editions. It's just like, get him into a bottleneck.
Yeah, you get him into a bottleneck because when he calls the Wa, the rules state that he has to go towards the nearest unit. So at that point, you have all of these units that are all sort of converging on one point, and it just starts clipping the shit out of them and blocking them, and it allows you, with your smaller force, to pick them to pieces because now they're screwed, their movement's blocked. You're right, because every example of that has been versus orcs.
Right, and for Grey Knights, which is a very good example of this in Warhammer 40,000, with Grey Knights, we kind of talked about it with the when we actually talked about the Codex. But deploying as this small force, and kind of keeping everything really close together and playing aggressive is probably the best thing that you can do if you're not playing the sit back and gun line it type Grey Knights army. Because you do have to support your stuff, and you can't really allow your opponent, we've said this before too, the worst thing you can do is allow your opponent to pick their fights. If you deploy in a very, very small force on the table, he can't pick his fights because picking one is essentially picking everything. You know he's going to get countercharged. He knows that even if he blows through that unit, he's in a really bad situation for shooting and for additional charges and things of that nature. So, I mean, when you're playing a small army, I'm a really big fan of keeping everything really close together, and making it an all or nothing shot, And I think that that's always going to kind of pay off better for you than spreading stuff out and feeling like you have to dominate the table edge, as I like to say. I mean, there's a lot of people out there who feel like they have to spread everything out on one big line and just march forward, and it does not work that way.
Well, and
Almost ever.
what I've also seen a lot of people do is they kind of get caught up in the matching, in the matching game. So it's like I put this unit down here, now you're going to counter it.
Yeah.
What I find in fantasy is specifically, it's basically what you do. Have a plan. When I build my army, I love symmetry. So you'll notice that almost all of my armies are just like one unit in the center, and then two almost identical units to guard each flank, and then on the, two almost identical units to match the, to guard the outside flanks.
Right.
Simply because it's easy, but even if you're not going to go for that symmetrical thing, just having a plan and saying, this is how I'm going to deploy. Now, what happens at turn one or turn two will depend on my opponent. I'm going to wait and see where he's going to commit his strength to, but always know what units in your army work best together and deploy them that way always. 40K, on the other hand, is very different because for me, it always depends. Am I going first or second? Because that will always
Yes.
dictate what it is that I'm doing. Because one thing that I find a majority of 40K gamers do not do enough is utilize voluntary reserves. Because you know what? I have never lost to the Leaf Blower in an Ardboys game because every time I go up against it and they get first turn, I just fucking reserve everything and just, laugh at them because they waste two rounds of shooting that they'll never get because I have nothing on the board. So at that point, it doesn't matter that you can drop six pie plates a turn. I don't care. So I mean, that's one of the things that you really have to, watch out for is what are you playing? What game are you playing, obviously? Because like I said, fantasy, have the plan, stick to it, always. You know, sure, the board, now that there's actually a lot of scenery on fantasy boards, which I love with eighth edition.
Yeah.
You know, you might shift it from dead center to center left to center right, or possibly even just play a denied flank, where you're just going to cram everything on one side of the board and make him come at you.
Yeah, I always have to laugh about the denied flank because people always talk about it. No one ever does it.
I did that once to you, and you were just like, I don't know what to do now, because your army was so much bigger that you had like two units hanging out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, that was my vampires.
Yeah, you know, because you're absolutely right, though. A lot of people do talk about it, but no one really does it. And I mean, if you're running a Death Star and you see he's got like MSU Dark Elves, where he's just got lots and lots of small units, do it, because either he's going to be doubling up, which allows you to take out his army single file, or he's going to be spread out in that long, thin line, and he can't bring a third of his forces to bear on you. So, I
Right.
mean,
Well,
it's definitely valid.
and a big part of that is really knowing your opponent's army and kind of trying to look at their deployment with a strategic eye. I think another big thing that people do poorly when they're deploying is either they are deploying in that kind of reactionary way where you deploy a unit, so they'll deploy a unit exactly across from it that they know can win that fight or that they think is going to capitalize on where you deployed. But typically, that doesn't have a huge payoff. If you see your opponent who is deploying what you would think to be primarily flanking units in the middle of the board, and he hasn't deployed his Death Star yet, or he hasn't deployed his big hitting units yet, kind of really look at it and say, think to yourself, is he going to deploy it on a flank? Like if that's in the center, if his giant's in the center of the table with Rhinox Riders on one side and like a really small unit of Lead Belchers on the other side, like that Death Star is going on a flank. And he's going to try to push that flank and run through your army from the flank and essentially put you off stance. Now, the problem with playing a refused flank and deploying that way, again, we're talking about fantasy here because there's almost no such thing in 40K, is that it's going to take an extra turn before anything happens. Just get used to that. You're going to put your opponent off of his game. He's going to have to readjust. He's going to essentially take turn one to redeploy. And you're essentially going to take turn one to redeploy and kind of like get the proper facings and get set up for the fight that you want to fight. So you do have to kind of take that into account when you're talking about scenarios as well, because you can't pull a refused flank off when you're playing Watchtower. So you have to understand that like you can't build your army around these types of deployment styles. It just doesn't really work that way.
No, absolutely. Like that's really the truth of it. Like, if I was going to give any advice on deployment, first of all is try to know what your opponent's army has. Ask lots of questions if you don't know. I mean, I do that all the time. Like, I played a dwarf army on at Ardboys, and I know next to nothing about dwarves, especially because he didn't have an army builder. It was just like, this guy has this rune and this rune and this rune, and I was just like, I don't know what those do. Ask questions, because you know what, I've yet to run into a guy that refuses to answer them, probably because I'm a big guy and he knows I'd beat his ass if he did. Like I
Such a
said, it's just
bully.
you look. Why wouldn't I be a bully?
You're just
Seriously.
like, I'm tall. Hey, I
That's
know the
right.
feeling.
No, but I mean, it's one of those things where, I'm all for open lists in events. So I mean,
Yes.
you should be able to see what your opponent has, so it's not an issue of, ha, you just fell for one of the classic blunders.
Never started land war in Asia.
That's right. Something dumb like that, it's much
Yeah.
better to be outplayed than to be tricked.
Right.
So I mean, play an open list so that way you see what he has, you can kind of look at it and gauge, holy shit, this guy has 21 placements. He knows he's not getting the plus one to go, for first turn. He knows it. So obviously his army's got a lot of bait, a lot of throwaways. So what can you do to try to play to your strengths and kind of force him into his weaknesses? And deployment is one of those really great sort of evening ones. Because, I mean, if both armies are 7 units, Big deal, you're not gonna have that opportunity. But if this guy has like three times the number of units to place for deployment, use that to your advantage. Don't go right in the middle because that's playing to his strengths. Because now he can hit you in the front and flank you on both sides. You know, if you move off to the center, he's got units that will never play a part in the game.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, like, we talk more about 40K and fantasy, and kind of every time we go back to deployment for 40K, it's always just kind of like, well, you know, that doesn't even count. Like, what do you think needs to change in 40K to make deployment really kind of mean something again? Do you think it just has to be like a different charge order?
Honestly, what I would say it is because after that APOC game with Maddie, I was kind of thinking about it. I was just like, I think 40K 6th edition needs to move to guaranteed reserve rolls. You know, because in APOC, half of the units in reserve come out turn two automatically, the other half come out turn three. Period. End of discussion. So I think if you were to move to a system like this, you're going to see people that are more willing to try voluntary reserves because the problem with it right now is, because I mean, I mentioned, hey, I do this with Tyranids, but I get a plus one to my reserve roll. So I come out three plus turn two.
Yeah.
You know, there are only two other guard, two other armies that can do that. And then there are two armies beyond those that can get rerolls on reserve rolls, and one of them is a special character.
Okay,
You
but
know,
reserves.
no. I'm getting to it.
Okay.
So I mean, right now, because of this, because of the fact that armies cannot reliably get things into reserve, you do not see players who are willing to take that risk because it is a risk. Because if I roll it up and I get two units in on turn two and eight units stay in reserve, those two units get fucked and they're dead. So right now, what you always see with 40K, and this is that problem, is if I'm going first, I get to dictate where everything's going to happen. My assault units are as close as possible with the best, cover lanes. My shooting units have the best fire lanes. You're going second, so you have to deploy automatically as a reactionary force because you cannot bank on a 1 in 6 chance of seizing the initiative. So
Okay.
you're just going to go to ground against his shooting units. You're going to try to move away. You're going to hide from everything. And basically, your deployment is dictated. And that's why it never really matters, because it's just, if I'm going second, my deployment has been dictated by
Right.
my opponent. And I have that one outflanking unit that I wrote into my list who will always outflank.
Right.
That's my deployment every single game, dictated by my opponent. And I think that is because there is no surefire way to improve reserve rolls or have them come out reliably. So people aren't willing to put the entire fate of this game up to the fickle dice gods.
Well, okay. I mean, I do agree with that. I see where you're going with it. I think the biggest problem with deployment in Warhammer 40,000 is there's no drawback to deploying anywhere on the table. If you deploy a unit that a veteran player might not deploy on the flank, and you're just like, fuck it, I'm putting it on the flank, it'll still do what it needs to do. Might do to turn late, might do to turn early. Might be out of position, like, okay, sure. But I mean, it's so easy to kind of follow up with support in Warhammer 40,000 that I think that like you could almost deploy at random and you would be just as good. And I think that that's also interesting when you start looking at Warhammer Fantasy, is there is the Dawn Attack scenario, which is essentially deployment at random. And I mean, like, we played where it was my orcs versus your demons, and oh my God, that fucked us both. We were so out of position, like we just couldn't fathom, like, but if I have to put this here,
Yeah, but that's because like our dice were so weird. You rolled everything in the center, and
everything in the center.
I did not get anything in the center. I only got both flanks and one unit at choice. So I was just like, well, now what? Like, I'm just like, I'm not going to put him in the center because now he's unsupported.
And it was very clear throughout that game how off-putting it was to have that happen. If you looked at that game for Warhammer 40,000, it would just be like, eh, I'll just move him to the left next turn.
You're absolutely right. Because in Warhammer 40,000, with transports, you get around faster. And with heavy weapons that have 4 and 6 and 7 foot weapons ranges, you're right. It absolutely does not matter. And I do think that that is interesting because even beyond Dawn Attack, meeting engagement, meeting engagement can absolutely fuck up your plans. Because if you roll a one on your Death Star, okay, now I've got an entire army built to support a unit that's not on the table.
Right. Which is, of course, a detriment for playing the Death Star's kind of all legs in one basket type list is, yeah, it can be like a turn one defeat, essentially, or, you know, it comes in so badly out of position that there's almost no way to fight with it. You know, I think for the most part, when I look at deployment, I want to focus a little bit more on 40K here again as well. When I look at deployment for Warhammer 40,000, I mean, it does depend a lot on what I'm facing. Not just, you know, which unit I'm standing across from, but really the type of army that I'm facing. If you're playing against a Horde-style army, let's just say with your general Space Marine army or Eldar or something like that, like some middle-of-the-road, mediocre-style kind of take-all-comers army, you know, like how would you deploy against a Horde army that it doesn't include, like, hoping the terrain allows you to bottleneck?
I mean, if I'm playing, like, you know, a middle-of-the-road in terms of numbers army, at that point, I'm going to consolidate all of my shooting units to be together. So that way, when combat gets there, because Hordes always have the bodies, that it's not a question of if, it's a when.
Right.
I have the ability to either countercharge, or if he wipes that shooting unit out, shoot him in the face, because he cannot sweeping advance into another combat. So he's just going to be hanging out there. So that way it gives me the flexibility to either countercharge with other shooting units, because you need to break that, because otherwise he's just going to take out unit after unit after unit. So, I mean, you've got to do something. Or shoot him in the face because he wiped my unit out. And then I do much the same with combat units, because you might have five Vanguard vets and they're fantastic. They throw out a good amount of attacks. They put the hurt on the tactical squad. But 30 orc boys are going to laugh. They don't care that your five Vanguard vets have 15 attacks or 20 attacks on the charge. Like, they really do not care, because they've got the bodies to soak it, and then they're going to kill you. So I always try to cluster all of my combat units around, so that way I can hit a unit so hard and take almost no casualties in return, and then use Fearless to wipe the unit out or wipe it down to one or two guys to the point where it's a non-issue. You know, so I mean, that's what I find you really have to do if you're fighting against a Horde, is just run everything together like they're big single units. You've got your one big single shooting unit, your one big single combat unit, and you just focus fire the shit out of your opponent.
So you're really an advocate for the deploy all the shooting units really close together and just try to drill a hole in the center of his army through the where it's going to do the most damage.
Yeah, absolutely. Because right. The other thing is if you're able to drill through the center with with your shooting and then hit one flank super hard with your combat, he now only has one, maybe two units that can get in and try to counterattack you, because the rest of it is going to be out of position. Because,
right.
I mean, what you have to do is you have to make his numbers a detriment. The fact that he has to spread across the board. Because, I mean, I remember the last Tyranid Codex, I ran a horde of almost 150 guys at 1,500 points. So, I mean, for me on a 4x6 board, I was taking up like 5 feet of it, you know. And so armies that would just cluster together in a corner were always really hard for me to kill, because my numbers got to the point where, you know, it was basically, you know, my units were taking a number and waiting in line because they couldn't all get in at the same time.
Yeah.
And that always hurt me.
No, I hear you. I think that is kind of, again, another interesting difference between Warhammer 40,000 and Warhammer Fantasy, is that in Warhammer Fantasy, when you start talking about deployment now, especially in 8th edition, you have to start thinking about your formations. I mean, you and I have both talked about, like, my Empire Army and your Dwarf Army that we're both planning on doing. And kind of talking about, like, well, now we have to build two different movement trays for every unit. Because depending on the army that you're playing, you're not only going to deploy them differently in terms of how the army gets put on the table, but you're deploying them differently in terms of their formation. Which, you know, there's nothing like that in Warhammer 40,000. It's just like you're deploying them as Amorphous Blob B or Amorphous Line C. You know, like, that's about as much of a difference as you're going to look at when you're deploying your army.
You're absolutely right. And I mean, right now with my demons, I have for my two big core blocks, because I mean, everything else is just sort of small supporting elements that don't really have movement trace. But for my two main blocks, I have two different movement trays made up that allow me to deploy them 10 by 3 in Horde, because they're both 30 strong, or 6 by 5 or 5 by 6, depending on which way I face that. And you're absolutely right. Because there are certain armies where I want to deploy in a Horde because I just want to throw out as many attacks as I possibly can and just kind of break them. And good examples of that are Chaos Warriors, because they don't have a ton of guys. They're never going to really be steadfast. So I just want to throw out as many dice as I can and just try to do as much damage as I can. You know, whereas on the exact flip side of that, if I roll up against an Empire army that's running, you know, lots of units that are 5 or 6 wide and super deep, you know, or Skaven or an army like this, I need to deploy narrower because A, I'm not going to get all of my models into attack, so it's a waste. And B, you know, I don't want him to be steadfast for 3 full game turns because that means I'm basically going to get one charge off, grind a worthless unit to dust, and then the game is over and I lose on victory points. You know, so it's just one of those things where I need to be able to look at my opponent, look at what he's fielding, look at how his formations are going down, and then from that choose whether I need to go to disrupt steadfast by having lots of ranks or go for lots of attacks.
Hey, you remember back in the day when the Guard had some cool rules? And one of those cool rules was allowing you to deploy your unit of guardsmen in base-to-base contact in a line, and it essentially gave them +1 leadership and +1 initiative.
Didn't it also give... No, it was another drill that gave him +1 weapon skill, but
it was another drill that gave him +1 weapon skill. That was that one, close order drill.
Yeah, because you're absolutely right. It was such a fun, fluffy thing to do because you're right. If everyone was in base-to-base contact, you got these really great benefits. Right. But it didn't cost you points. So it was just one of those things where it's just like, pray to God your opponent doesn't have a flamer because you only have flak armor. Like, flamer's going to ruin you.
But I think that aspect in that one tiny little bitty rule, if you put that, imagine if close order drill was a standard rule for all of Warhammer 40,000, and every army could use it, and it cost 0 points, and it was just like, yeah, we understand. If they have pie plates, it sucks. But guess what? You've got +1 initiative and +1 leadership. How many people would go back and kind of reimagine their armies with this idea of, well, hey, you know, if I deploy like this, this could really, really benefit my army, you know? And I think that that's what's lacking in Warhammer 40,000 when it comes to deployment is there's no options. It's just you deploy the unit. Welcome to the danger zone. Like, hey, everybody, you're an amorphous blob of space marines, and you move as an amorphous blob of space marines. That slowly gets smaller. Like, it just – there's nothing to it, right? Like, there's no thought that goes into it. It's just – I remember – what was it? I was playing a guy, and he was playing an orc army. And he said, okay, I'm going to deploy my orc unit. And he just grabs a handful of 15 orcs, and he literally just drops them on the table in a pile. And he was just like, okay, they're deployed. Now, obviously, he goes and he starts separating them out. But it's like, I didn't have to wait for him to separate them out to see exactly where they got deployed. I knew. It was just like, he deployed that amorphous blob there.
Yeah.
Like, that was all there is to it. We don't have to wait for anything.
Yeah, I mean, my Tyranids do that all the time. I mean, usually late in the game. I'm very anal when I deploy to make sure that everything looks all... Ah, who am I kidding? My Tyranids don't deploy anymore. I just go for a reserve bomb army. But I mean, you know, late in the game when I've got like a pile of 20 gaunts, I absolutely do that because it's just like, oh my God, time's going to be called in 15 minutes and you've been slow playing me, so this is only turn 3.
Right.
Okay, fistful of gaunts, move, they're charging. Oh, you have flame templates? Okay, if I break this combat, I'll spread them out.
Well,
like, fuck.
Let's kind of get our final thoughts here before we move on to the stupidity check for this week, which is yours.
Yep.
And let's get some final thoughts. Obviously, ogres, they need a new book more than anyone. Fuck your elves.
More than anyone that isn't called wood elves.
Yeah, right. Anyways. Whiny, whiny bastard. Okay, deployment. I think really a good 40K player is going to have a plan when it comes to deployment. I mean, like, I understand that if you're playing 40K and that's your main game and you're listening to this podcast right now, you're kind of thinking to yourself that, we're really, really down playing 40K, which is partially true, but any good 40K general, like I said before, they're going to have a plan with regards to the types of units that they're taking and deploying, and they're kind of deploying them in those little islands, right? Whether it's a one unit island or it's a two or three unit island, it's always going to get kind of deployed the same with a general plan. And if you're playing a parking lot, I'm sure you've got a great deployment plan that involves hugging a table edge.
Possibly two.
Possibly two table edges. Oh my God, don't get my blood up. But for Warhammer Fantasy, I think really, if you're playing a small army, try to keep it together. Something that I didn't get to mention before about deployment for fantasy, I was playing against a buddy of mine, and he has a wonderfully built Beastman army. Really good army, well-built units, lots of great stuff on the table, and he deployed it in such a way that it looked so small compared to my undead army, because I had deployed them all together as this very cohesive group, right? And after the game was over, after I pantsed him, I went back and I kind of showed him. I was just like, if you deploy like this, this, and this, like go look on the other side of the table. If you deploy your stuff together and you deploy it as like a cohesive army instead of trying to dominate that table edge, you'll actually real like you'll notice how much meaner that army looks, like how much tougher it looks. You don't want to deal with it so much. The way he had deployed, like there was 8, 9 inches between units, like it was all over the place. So try to come up with a solid plan, which for me is always a solid center unit, which is typically the general, two solid support units, two solid flanking units, and then there's always the wild card units, which, they'll fucking go anywhere. I mean, sometimes they end up going between units, sometimes they end up going on the flank, sometimes they end up riding the coattails of the army behind two or three units, just to make sure they're safe until I need them, but have a plan. We've said it before, have a plan, and you really can't go wrong. What do you think, Nathan?
Yeah, I mean you're absolutely right. I mean ogres are the second most deserving army of an update. we're gonna have this
Blah,
argument a
blah,
lot
blah,
at
blah,
work this
blah.
week.
Like you said, we need to have a pathetic off. It'll be your wood elves versus my ogres, and we'll see who's the most pathetic.
Now, are we going to tailor for 8th edition, or are we just going to take our old 7th edition lists
I
and
was
have a
thinking
slap
about
fight
that
like that?
too. I'm almost thinking we should take our 7th edition lists.
Ooh, that's going to be even worse. But
Because
anyway,
I've got a
that'll.
bunch of like 3-man and like 6-man units of ogres.
I have Glade Guard I don't use anymore. But anyway. With that, again, with fantasy, try to play to your strengths. You obviously know, what your army is good at doing. You know where your synergies lie. So always try to deploy in such a way that you're not going to get blocked off by buildings, or you're not going to force your chariots to run through a forest and possibly explode.
That is a great bit of advice.
Hey, I miss the old frenzy rules because I cannot tell you how many chariots I have destroyed by forcing frenzy charges into forests with wood
Oh,
elves.
boy.
But no, so I mean, like, it's just like that. Look at the board, shift your deployment based on it so that way you're not going to have to break up your own units and synergy. But otherwise, play to your strengths because usually. If you play to your army's strengths, it's going to do a lot better than your opponent's army's strengths.
Right.
Straight up, because he's not going to be able to deploy in a way to counter you one for one.
Yes.
And then in 40K, as Lang said, we definitely downplayed it a lot. Good generals do have their plans. This goes here, this goes there, but really what it does come down to is if you win that dice roll for first turn, don't be a chicken shit. I know a lot of people that, despite winning that dice, are just like, but he could seize the initiative, so I'm not going to deploy out in the open. I'm going to move him into the cover instead. like I said, don't be a chicken shit, because there's only a 1 in 6 chance, and if you ever play against me, I will never seize the initiative, because I have never seized the initiative. It's part of the reason I just play a reserve bomb army now, is, you know, if I know I'm always going second, I'll build an army to go second, and it does well. You know, but it's just, if you're going first, deploy like you're going first. Deploy like you haven't got a care in the world, because he might start second guessing himself. And if you are going second, like I said, unfortunately, a lot of your deployment is dictated by him, you know?
Yeah. Well, and I think that that's a huge point as well, is really don't second guess yourself. I mean, if we're going to leave it on anything, I mean, that would be my biggest bit of advice, would just be don't second guess yourself. Stick to your plan. You know, it was a good plan when you thought it up. It's probably still a good plan. And, you know, like, it's always going to change depending on the type of army that you're playing. But, you know, like, when you were thinking it up, it's not like you were thinking, like, well, I'm always going to play Vampire Counts, or I'm always going to play Imperial Guard, you know. Stick to your plan. Come up with that take-all-comers list and that take-all-comers deployment. And, you know, you'll be in good shape. And like Nathan says, don't be a chicken shit.
Yeah. No, like I said, you know, it's only a 1 in 6 chance. I mean, sure, if you're playing against a Dark Eldar army who has his Drubiel Vect, it's down to a 1 in 2. You know, it's a coin
Come
flip.
On.
But at that point, he did just spend 100 points on an extra above and beyond what a normal Archon would cost.
Yes.
For marginally better gear and that, you know, get it on a 4 plus instead of a 6. Yes. But stupidity check?
Yes, let's do it.
I think what I'm going to do, you know, the internet was actually kind of slow this week. In
People
terms
were
of
quite happy with the Tomb Kings.
Yes, they were, which is crazy.
Yep.
You know, so I mean, I was going to go back and talk about scenario 3 for Ardboys. Typically, you know, specifically how Games Workshop either doesn't think things through or proofread. but Blood of Kittens posted something up today that I really wanted to talk about on the stupidity check, or actually today. Sorry, I just checked them today.
Well, they're a return customer.
That is true. But actually, it's not something that they're saying, because this is kind of like a long-standing debate, especially in 40K, and I think we're going to see it more in fantasy. And that is modeling to advantage. See,
God damn it.
See, now that True Line of Sight does exist in fantasy, I expect you're going to start seeing it pop up at top tournaments.
Yep.
And the reason I want to call it a stupidity check is, you know, this may be news to everyone, but we play a fucking game. So if you yourself feel that the best way that you can play this game is to model your shit to be advantageous to you and you alone, go choke on a big bowl of dicks. Like that, you know, like that's really all I have to say. Like, it's such a big, huge stupidity check, because at the end of the day, when I play a game, if I win, I want to know that I was better. That's why I like to play, you know, I fairly model everything, and I want to play with open lists, because I want to know that at the end of the day, you know, if all things are created equal, and we both know that sometimes dice aren't, right, Link?
Fuck yourself. You know, jab, jab, I, jab, 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 jab. Whatever, dude. You know what's up.
Look, as we said before,
stick
we
to
said
the
we
topic, talk, you monkey.
Off, your dice are afraid of me, and they're win. But like I said, I really do think that anyone that has to model to advantage just to try to get a cover save, or to block line of sight, or do any of that sort of bullshit shenanigans, it's definitely a failed stupidity check, because I think they're missing the point that this is a game. And I don't care if you're playing at Adepticon, if you're playing at the ETC, you know, or you're playing at Ardboys, this is still a game. People play it for fun, and modeling for advantage just makes you the asshole.
Yes.
And, well, and that's really what it comes down to.
I think that the other part of this for me is the people who get so incensed about it, you know, where they're just like, these motherfuckers are changing the height. They're ordering old giants, Nathan, because they're shorter. Yeah. Like, I mean, people are just, they lose their goddamn minds over this idea of just like, they're taking advantage of the rules. But
yeah.
You know, it's the equivalent of some senator in the United States sitting there going like, all immigrants want to do is have babies on American soil. And that's all they're trying to do is have babies on American soil. And this is ruining our economy. And you're just like, wait, this is ruining our economy? And they're like, yes, it's ruining our economy. How the fuck is this? How the fuck is like one mother every 5 months having a baby on American soil ruining the economy? And they're just like, it ruins the goddamn economy. And you're just like, that's how I look at this argument.
Yeah.
About modeling for advantage. They're just like, there's a guy, and he modeled his giant leaning over so that it can hide behind this tree. And I'm just like, really? He did that? So how often has that won him games? Well, never, but he did it.
Yeah. Well, I do think that that's the other thing, because there's actually a local player here in Cowtown that some people have accused of modeling for advantage, and admittedly, that may be the case. You know, I'm not the guy. I can't speak for him. But I'm with you. You know, I think that sort of mob mentality of, you know, let's go lynch him because his land raider is twice as wide as a normal land raider.
Right.
is just as ridiculous as the player itself. Like
all orcs model for advantage. it's so fucking ridiculous.
All of my commanders are crawling on their stomachs.
Yes.
It's a cover.
Yes. Shit. Like, oh my lord.
You know, like I said, I really think that that's a failed stupidity check, both on part of the player that actually was sitting there thinking of how he could competitively model. And on the other hand, the community that literally just wants to get their torches and pitchforks anytime a guy shows up with models that they deem to have been competitively, you know,
right. Well, modeled. And like I said, I've got my slave giant for my Ogre Kingdoms army, which I think is a great example, because I was using the old Albion giant, which is like junior giant in training, and even beside an ogre, he's not even twice the size of an ogre. And then the old metal giant was bigger than he is, and now the new plastic giant is like twice his size. So, like, when I go and I show up with my old Albion giant, I put him on the table, it's just like, oh, yeah, he hides behind cover just fine. But it's not because I'm trying to screw the rules. It's literally just because, like, that's the pose that I wanted to do my slave giant, because it was conversion.
Well, exactly, you know.
But now people are saying, like, oh, you're modeling to advantage.
Well, you know, exactly, and that isn't the case, because I remember when you were building that, you were just like, but the Albion giant's so thin, it looks like he's starved. Why
right,
wouldn't
like a
I get
giant.
Him? Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you know, that's the thing is I think that everybody just needs to take a chill pill.
Yeah.
If you yourself are sitting at home thinking of how you can competitively, get a competitive advantage through modeling your army, like I said, go choke on a bowl of dicks. We don't need your kind playing this game. if you see someone and you think that's what they did, take a chill pill, relax. You know what?
Win the game.
Yeah, win the game. It doesn't matter. So I like it. Just everybody just needs to take a chill pill and relax, because, like I said, it just, you look at it, and this same argument has been cropping up every 6 months since fifth edition came out, and it's only a matter of time until someone does it. Like, I'm surprised, you know, when True Line of Sight came out, someone didn't, you know, yell and scream about how playing dwarves is competitively modeling because they're shorter. You know, like, it's just like,
yes!
Stupid dwarf players! They should all be on a
bunch of cheaters. Bunch of dirty-ass cheaters.
Yeah, that's the thing for me. Like, everybody just needs to relax. It's a game.
Well, we talked about True Line of Sight again when we had the mailbag episode, and I mean, I'm not going to get into it really, but, you know, I will just reiterate, I think that there's so many arguments for it as there are against it. I mean, if for every con, you can come up with a pro, and for every aspect of the game that's changed in a bad way, you can come up with the ways that it's changed in a good way, and so forth and so on. Take a chill pill, as Nathan says. But that is Jaded Gamercast for this week. My name is Lang.
I'm Nathan.
Have a good one.
Cheers.